You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Saskia Sassen from Columbia University. Saskia, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, I'm delighted.
Saskia, we're going to talk, I believe, mostly about the new edition of your book, Cities in a World Economy, that just was updated. Is that correct?
Yes, it's the fifth edition. I can't believe it.
Well, I can't believe how many books you've written and the depth that you go into about world economies and all the complexity involved. So in this new edition, what has been altered or changed? And perhaps that'll give readers who don't know the book also an insight into what you're discussing here in terms of flows of money and information.
Right. Well, this is the best edition yet. I have taken full responsibility for it. In the past, every now and then, I gave several chapters to assistants, you know, who are very good. But here I really decided that this, for me, is going to be the last one. And so I gave it my best. So I spent quite a bit of time trying to understand what is happening today, which may mark the beginning of new histories, new conditions, new geographies that we are not quite aware of yet, because what is emergent is often invisible. So a lot of my time was actually spent in sort of inferring what are our futures in the making, in the making as we speak. And so that gave it quite a different tenor. You know, what are the limits of existing modes that we have inherited, many of them since World War II, in a country like the United States, you know, but some changed in the 1980s when we privatized, deregulate, and globalize, and others are just really transversal elements that we never expected, like Trump.
Right. So in that context, and it's been so strange and curious for me, this whole series has taken place, or it's been going on for years, but talking to everybody, you know, throughout this whole election and how the world has changed for artists and thinkers all over the world. So there, to talk a little bit about that Trump effect or what's happening now, this is also a global issue, isn't it? While Trump is a kind of standout a clown a bit, there's a move to the right around the world, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And right-wing nationalisms, you know, there are different types of nationalisms, but right-wing nationalisms are ascendant. Frankly, when I'm at my most brutal, I think that we, the nice, you know, intellectuals and people who, whatever, you know, we try to be good and to enable our readers, et cetera, that they learn something. I think we have really failed. We have failed in being on alert that the system that in a way delivered the goods, I would say, until the 1980s in the United States. You know, the middle classes were growing. The working classes were still solidly centered in real economies. And we sort of did not pick up. I mean, frankly, I did, but I sort of in general, I often didn't even talk about it because it seemed so extreme what I was saying. We didn't pick up on the fact of the profound degradation, which took the form and hence was less visible, of something that was very grand, very rich, like, you know, this 30% of families or individuals that have become very rich. It's not the 1%. The 1% has always been there. But it's the 30%. In a city like Manhattan, it's the 40%. And then the other 50%, strictly speaking, 53.1%, are poorer than they ever thought they would be. They're below the poverty line. You know, we did not see coming this dualizing of our city. And that, when it happens at that scale, you know, if it's the 1%, we barely notice it, they've always been there. But, you know, if it is a good solid 30% or even 40%, we notice it. And so all kinds of professors can no longer live in Manhattan, just to mention one very practical item, you know. So I have sort of been struck at how we haven't seen it coming. And so now I'm in this mode, something is disassembling, not just in the United States. but in other countries as well. The solidity of the notion of the nation state, the sovereign territory, I just don't buy it anymore. I think we are disassembling that. You know, it's sort of disintegrating. But, I mean, the actual land, the materiality of land, camouflages this disintegration because we still have borders, you know. But those borders are there for some but not for others, right? So we take in any billionaire can come and live here. Same thing in the UK, same thing in Australia, same thing in a whole bunch of countries, right? So, but if you're poor, a laborer who may have big muscles and great talents to do hard labor, we don't treat them like. So, for me, we're seeing the decay of a certain type of governance system that has served us very, very well until the 1980s. And, I mean, this, I'm not with the United States. It varies a bit in other countries. Huh? But the United States is a pretty extreme case for what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And now we've entered a new period. And I think we still think that this, everything that we're living now, really started after World War II when we got our act very well together, you know, the growing middle classes and all of that. And I think we are wrong. I think in the 1980s marks a point, really starts in the late 1970s, marks the point of a real difference. And one element in the difference is the extraordinary power that high finance has gotten, which has nothing to do with economics. High finance is not about economics, nor is it traditional finance. Huh? It's something else. It actually, when I want to be very provocative, I like to say it's an extractive sector. It's like mining. Once it takes it out for what it needs it, it doesn't matter what happens with the site from where it was taken out. And that's quite different, say, from the traditional small commercial operation where the middle class is bought, you know, the little bank, the little, all the shops, the sort of the businesses. You know, the clients would come back and their children hopefully would also be clients. You know, there was a sense of different generations over time. So you cared about your clients. Because their children, you wanted them to be your clients too. That really breaks in the 1980s because other sectors become ascendant.
And so what is an example of high finance? Is this hedge fund managers? Is that what we're talking about? Because that's
a very different
ethical point of view when you talk about children and seeing the future that way. This is more short-sighted of the future.
Exactly, and that is one element. But so high finance, as I said, you know, if we start thinking about it as an extractive sector, we already know that we're dealing with something different from traditional banking. And I repeat, traditional banking, we need it all. It's commerce. It sells something, money, for a price. You know, like we shop for all kinds of other things in the same way. So finance, actually, finance can, number one, financialize all kinds of things like buildings. We think the building is the actual element in play. No. The building via algorithmic mathematics, because that's at the heart of high finance, is algorithmic math. It has nothing to do with microeconomics or with macroeconomics. So the building that we see, the building, that, so they bought the building, and so they, you know, whatever. The building is empty. We have quite a few very elegant, big, fancy buildings in New York, in Manhattan, which are quite empty, if not fully empty. So here's the extreme version of what I'm getting at, and being extreme, it might help explain. So we see the building, and we say, oh, my God, the investors in this building got it wrong, and the building is all empty. Poor thingies, they're losing. Actually, via algorithmic mathematics, which has nothing to do, I repeat, with traditional economics or microeconomics or traditional banking, you actually can transform that building into a set of assets. The building becomes an absolute a fullness of assets, precisely partly because it's empty, it's easier to move, you don't have to bother about the people. Did a pipe break down? Is the water not flowing? Is the temperature not right? No people in that building. Perfect. The ideal situation. And you're actually using, it might be a toilet, it might be a whole floor, whatever. But the materiality of the building has been transformed into asset. And so you can create asset-backed securities. And you can buy, sell those in one day many times or whatever, you know, in a month many times. So a lot of profit is being generated based on empty buildings. Because the building...
And let me just interrupt for a moment. You're talking about residential buildings as opposed to commercial buildings. Or does
no, it could also be... It could also be a commercial building, you know, that is not full, that they don't manage to. But at the most extreme, I would say that at some point, even a commercial empty building might deliver more goods. The key element here is the demand, and hence it depends on another actor. The demand by the high investment circuit, you know, the high investment entities, firms, individuals.
Who are trading these empty buildings with each other. And keeping them empty because it's easier to trade them because they're empty.
Well, the limit it is that, though it can also take, it's a more intermediated, like you they don't want derivatives anymore, they want asset-backed securities. Asset becomes the thing because derivatives, you know, at the start they worked very well, but that was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, more. But then eventually the chains of the derivative where it came from were so long that the high investment circuit, who really knows their stuff, they don't want derivatives. The derivatives is what they're selling to us, to our retirement plans, to universities' retirement plans, you know, that kind of stuff. So I am now on guard. I don't want too many derivatives, you know, in my whatevers. So what you have actually is via algorithmic mathematics, and that is radically different from traditional economics or microeconomics. Hey, it's a different world. But via algorithmic mathematics, you actually, what we see as a building is transformed often by 10 complex steps. This is all physicists in the back office of Goldman Sachs. It's no longer secretaries. It's all physicists. Nor is it they have some, of course, microeconomists, etc., but the core knowledge in this highly innovative, highly aggressive, and highly effective mode, asset-backed securities, which are, is physicists. It's not...
Why physicists? I would think if anything, you know, if they're managing algorithms or understanding algorithms, wouldn't that be computer scientists?
Well, computer scientists are one thing. But physicists it's a form of knowledge, you know, that is quite extraordinary, that can deal with enormous chains of little transformations that produce a difference at the end. And that is what we're talking about. So the microeconomists are still in all of these banks because it is sort of standard issue. But the real action... This is now well established. This is not my discovery. I want to clarify that. This is pretty well established. The real action is in algorithmic mathematics rather than microeconomics. And that is really the domain of physicists. They may have some other forms of knowledge in there, but basically it's physicists. So one image that I like to think of, you know, where before you had 100, in some big financial firm, you had 100 people doing microeconomics, or you had the secretaries. Now you have physicists, because it takes quite a few physicists. So it is a profound transformation. I mention all of this just to emphasize that high finance really needs to be differentiated from traditional, you know, banking. Traditional banking is something we all need. Traditional banks, I'm not putting them down, you know. I think that it's commerce. It's an instrumentality that we can all use. Whereas this high finance bit is really quite different. And that is why they have made such an extraordinary amount of money. Because, you know, we're talking trillions.
And you're saying this is what contributes to the 40% in New York and the kind of divide between the classes since the 80s?
Yes. Because it really takes, and you can really respect and admire the intelligences of that 30 or 40%. I mean, these are really smart people. They are not just business types who are hanging in there. They construct these new algorithms. Because remember, the algorithm is an open thing. Yeah? So 5-year-olds can also create algorithms, yeah? But clearly they're much simpler. So one has to respect. These are very smart people, so I'm not blaming the physicists. I respect and admire their intelligence. But, you know, we know that physics has become a key tool to understand quite a few features of our contemporary period. And many microeconomists have not picked up on it, but people who are really working on high finance, they know that. I mean, it's really quite a transformation, and it's not traditional banking. That's a key way of putting it.
And is it also something that has, the bar for entry is that you are a physicist or have knowledge sufficient enough to be able to work on, improve, or invent an algorithm that's effective?
No, exactly. The second also holds what you said. In other words, physicists have extraordinary bodies of knowledge. To do this high financial bit, you don't need to know all of the stuff that a physicist would know. Nor do the physicists use all of that other stuff either. But they can launch certain innovations, you know, that would be more difficult for your typical economist. Huh? So, I mean, in the United States is quite extreme in that most universities you have huge bodies of microeconomists. You know, when they say economics, they're really talking microeconomics because it lends itself to incredible formulas. It's very complex. Eh? You can do all kinds of formulas, etc. And so that is still the dominant mode in universities. But in a way, in the real world, you need another form of knowledge than that type of microeconomics. Microeconomics will get you only so far.
And so the other form of knowledge you need... No, it's fine. It's clear. I'm fascinated, and it's very interesting. So the other form of knowledge that's needed is an algorithmic understanding.
Yeah. And that is expanding. I mean, you know, also with the digital, there is a lot of that. I mean, the algorithm has become our tool, you know, the equivalent of whatever it might have been 30 years ago, some formula or some, you know, analytics from microeconomics. Today really is the algorithm. I mean, you hear many people talk about the algorithm, including people who may not know what exactly they're talking about.
We hear about it online. We've heard about it through the election, And I don't know if this is part of high finance. It sounds like it's not, but of course, an enormous amount of money is made online, specifically using algorithms.
Yeah.
Although this may be a lower level than what you're talking about, but algorithms to target,
it's also there.
Follow, find,
yeah,
and convince customers on a mass scale.
No, it really is quite something. And because you can construct an entity, you know, which is open, so you can always change it a bit, you can alter it, etc. But you construct something, and it can be very exciting, you know, and probably some people fall for it when it's not a very good one, or it's a bit of a dodgy one, but I don't know all those details. But to me, this is a very important transformation. And when they can begin to, and also it means that the material, you know, we tend to think a building is a building, a bridge is a bridge, a street is a street, a house is a house. You know, the materiality of all these instances sort of always mattered a lot. We could see it with our eyes, right? And so now we might see the building, but 7 steps later in a complex chain of little algorithmic moves, the building, it doesn't exist. Where the action actually happens, there is no building. There's a mountain of assets. It's like you have a huge field, all assets. Let me take the toilet, whatever. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. It's material. So I look at a building, and I know at certain kinds of, I mean, most buildings are buildings. They tell their tale. But these kinds of fancy buildings, and some of them are standing empty, and you see it in Milano, you see it in many different places. They're sort of centers of commerce and finance. They all have that now. So
where is this leading to? If that's the case, and this situation may just increase, that sounds like a dead end, you know, and that sounds like it's creating an impossibility. Or is this globally moving towards a huge again, gap between, you know, the 40%, as you were saying,
it's
and
both.
And the poverty line.
Yeah, it's both. It is also that second. I mean, it means that high finance, unlike traditional banking, should be seen as an extractive sector. It extracts. And as it is, I repeat, with a mine, once you have extracted, you're no longer interested. This is a sharp contrast with a traditional bank, which wants the sons and daughters of its current clients also to become its clients. You know, the traditional bank is
It's a kind of unbridled greed, isn't it?
In a way, yes, you can call it that. It's also absolutely brilliant stuff, you know. But it is absolutely, it's a bit devastating. And you also see what we don't know, because it has escalated, you know, in the last few years enormously, this algorithmic math insertion into what we used to think of as just pure economics. And so we don't know how far that can go, what else comes in. So I've been tracking. So it starts a bit in the United States. And in fact, when Bernanke, you know, the former head of our central bank, the Fed, when he steps down, he says all the good things, blah, 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 blah. And then he says, and there are two intractables. And one of them is, I don't know if he used, strictly speaking, the term intractable, but it was the equivalent or that word. I can't remember that. And he says, and one of them is this question of algorithmic mathematics. You know, that we really don't, and the fact, what I didn't mention yet, is that we're dealing with privatized networks. Networks owned by big banks or such, mostly big banks, and they create their own circuit for all these, you know, buy and sell and do and innovate, et cetera, et cetera. And there are long waiting lists of other banks or firms, you know, that want to be part of some of these, and it's so not easy to enter. So when we look at stock market values, we are seeing only part of the story. It used to be that the stock market was the stock market, and it involved everything that had to do with that kind of buy and sell, you know, in finance. Today, a lot of it is happening in privatized networks owned by banks, I repeat, with long waiting lists. So a lot of the stuff, like I look at the building is no longer simply a building. I look at the banks are not simply a bank. You know, there is and what strikes me, you know, I'm a bit of a theorist, so allow me the indulgence here.
Of course.
I'm just fascinated at this notion that I'm looking at these buildings and they have lost speech. They tell us less than they used to tell us. I mean, I'm talking about a minority of buildings. Yeah, I want to alert. But and I'm sitting here smiling, you know, because I find it also absolutely fascinating to just understand that. It's like it's a mind-blowing thing, you know, that my eyes and the materialities I'm looking at tell us only so much, tell us less than they used to. They never gave us a full story, but they certainly told us a good part of the story. Today, these particular kinds of buildings, and most buildings still tell the full story, basically, or as much as you can get out of a building as a story. But these particular big properties, many of which are half empty or totally empty, they tell us less because the action is not there. The action is several steps away in another space. And the building is just the source of materialities, you know. The building has been transformed into a field of toilets, walls, whatever. Doesn't matter. It's been neutralized. No longer exists as building. When the intervention happens, you know, by the financial system. So, I don't know. I just find it absolutely fascinating.
It is fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating. It's wonderful talking to you about this. So, as a listener, as an individual in this world who's neither in high finance, you know, but in New York, you know, whether it's an artist, a curator, or someone else, I would think the survival tactics in this kind of world are changing enormously. And by survival tactics, I really mean what it takes to live in a city like New York. As you were saying, professors can no longer live there by and large. And so we're entering this kind of housing issue almost because of the poverty that's being created by this type of mining activity. So what do you theorize would would be a survival technique of the future, of the next generation.
Right.
Is it to be physicists? Is it something else? I mean, how do you compete in that kind of world?
So, 2 points. One is that we need to recognize this, you know, that there is a kind of lack of need of a population in many of these top-level economic sectors. They used to need people as clients. A traditional bank needed people. This has shifted. So we, in turn, should know this and should construct our own realities. You know, I really think that this is a very particular period where we should care more about other people, our neighborhoods, etc., than sort of trying to be like the top, you know, because the top is a bit putrid. Is that an English term? Putrid?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, and I mean it literally, you know, and it's unreachable. Now, the other point I would like to make is that this sphere of activity, innovations, brilliant minds, blah, blah, that I'm talking about, you know, it's just one little bit of any big city. Most of the city is familiar ground. But what I want to say is that we should valorize that other city, which is most of the city, right? Because that's people-centered. The shops, the little banks, that's all people-centered. There you have mutual needs. We need the bank needs little clients. Huh? The few traditional banks that still exist. In some countries there are more than fewer have gone than have in the United States. So for me, the critical issue becomes really, number one, I think of everything as a curve, and I already now, we know that this kind of system, which has produced extreme concentration of wealth at the top and extremely high valuations of all these very high level, you know, experimental moves, etc., that it is on the decline now. Now, it may rise again. This may be a momentary decline. But something, none of these systematicities or systems, whatever language we might want to use, has lasted forever. They all partly self-destruct. There are going to be losses. Some losers have to be part of the story. Now, what comes next is what I don't know. But for me right now, what seems important is to recognize that this extraordinarily powerful sector is already beginning to give signals, especially that which is in the public domain. What we don't know is all those privately owned huge networks where many banks are also involved in. Huh? But what we know is that it is beginning to lose steam because it is so extractive that it actually consumes itself. Right, there is something about being an extractive sector, you know, like a mine. When they're done extracting, they are really done. It's dead.
Right.
So that is sort of an interesting dimension, I would say, that I am tracking right now. I want to detect the signs that high finance begins to lose ground, begins to lose grip, cannot deploy some of those instruments it has deployed for the last 30 years or more. Very effectively, et cetera, et cetera.
Saskia, it's wonderful talking to you about this. Thank you. I'm smiling too over here, and I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment. I know we could talk much more about this, but I'd love to know what you're reading.
Yes, I'm reading a book that I really recommend. It's called Body and Soul: The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. And at the center is really medical discrimination, and the Black Panther Party is one actor in it. And it's written by Alondra Nelson, who is an absolutely wonderful scholar. So that is what I'm reading. It's on my desk here.
Saskia, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.